In the mythologies of many cultures, there appears the story of the phoenix, the bird which is consumed by fire and yet rises alive from the ashes. This myth of the phoenix, of life rising from the ashes of destruction, is a myth or symbol in which we may no longer believe. Other generations may have been convinced that life always rises once again. But for us, the myth no longer works as well. When we think of ashes, of catastrophic events, we no longer imagine only the violent storms or eruptions of nature, which are followed inevitably by rainbows and peaceful days. Nor do we imagine a cosmic collision with other planets or meteors, because we know that such events are beyond our control. Even the fall of a great city and the suffering of its people is not an adequate example of what destruction means to us. When the ashes settle, we go on living, build a new city. If that were our only image of destruction, we might still find hope and faith in the symbol of the phoenix. But we don't. The kind of destruction we envision is far more complex, insidious, and total. In 1962, Rachel Carson wrote the following, which she called A Fable for Tomorrow. There was once a town in the heart of America where all life seemed to live in harmony with its surroundings. The town lay in the midst of a checkerboard of prosperous farms with fields of grain and hillsides of orchards, where in spring white clouds of bloom drifted above the green fields. In autumn, oak and maple and birch set up a blaze of color that flamed and flickered across a backdrop of pines. Then foxes barked in the hills and deer silently crossed the fields, half hidden in the mists of the fall mornings. Along the roads, laurel, viburnum, and alder, great ferns and wildflowers delighted the traveler's eye through much of the year. Even in winter, the roadsides were places of beauty, where countless birds came to feed on the berries and on the seed heads of the dried weeds rising above the snow. The countryside was, in fact, famous for the abundance and variety of its bird life. And when the flood of migrants was pouring through in spring and fall, people traveled from great distances to observe them. Others came to fish the streams, which flowed clear and cold out of the hills and contained shady pools where trout lay. So it had been from the days many years ago when the first settlers raised their houses, sank their wells, and built their barns. Then a strange blight crept over the area, and everything began to change. Some evil spell had settled on the community. Mysterious maladies swept the flocks of chickens. The cattle and sheep sickened and died. Everywhere was a shadow of death. The farmers spoke of much illness among their families. In the town, the doctors had become more and more puzzled by new kinds of sickness appearing among their patients. There had been several sudden and unexplained deaths, not only among adults, but even among children, who would be stricken suddenly while at play and die within a few hours. And there was a strange stillness. The birds, for example, where had they gone? Many people spoke of them, puzzled and disturbed. The feeding stations in the backyards were deserted. The few birds seen anywhere were moribund. They trembled violently and could not fly. It was a spring without voices. On the mornings that had once throbbed with the dawn chorus of robins, catbirds, doves, jays, wrens, and scores of other bird voices, there was now no sound. Only silence lay over the fields and woods and marsh. On the farms, the hens brooded, but no chicks hatched. The farmers complained that they were unable to raise any pigs. The litters were small, and the young survived only a few days. The apple trees were coming into bloom, but no bees droned among the blossoms. So there was no pollination, and there would be no fruit. The roadsides, once so attractive, were now lined with browned and withered vegetation, as though swept by fire. These, too, were silent, deserted by all living things. Even the streams were now lifeless. Anglers no longer visited them, for all the fish had died. In the gutters under the eaves and between the shingles of the roofs, a white granular powder still showed a few patches. Some weeks before, it had fallen like snow upon the roofs and the lawns, the fields and streams. No enemy action had silenced the birth of new life in this stricken world. The people had done it themselves. Having written the fable, Carson spelled out the specifics of what had become one of our primary visions of what has become one of our primary visions of destruction. She wrote, "Only within the moment of time represented by the present century has our species acquired significant power to alter the nature of the world. During the past quarter century, this power has not only increased to one of disturbing magnitude, but it has changed in character. The most alarming of all our assaults upon the environment is the contamination of air, earth, rivers, and sea with dangerous and even lethal materials. This pollution is for the most part irrecoverable. The chain of evil it initiates, not only in the world that must support life, but in living tissues, is for the most part irreversible. In this now universal contamination of the environment, chemicals are the sinister and little recognized partners of radiation in changing the very nature of the world, the very nature of life. Strontium 90, released through nuclear explosions into the air, comes to earth in rain or drifts down as fallout, lodges in soil, enters into the grass or corn or wheat grown there, and in time takes up its abode in the bones of a human being, there to remain until that person's death. Similarly, chemicals sprayed on croplands or forests or gardens lie long in soil, entering into living organisms, passing from one to another in a chain of poisoning and death. Or they pass mysteriously by underground streams until they emerge and, through the alchemy of air and sunlight, combine into new forms that kill vegetation, sicken cattle, and work unknown harm on those who drink from once pure wells." Well, in 1962, few people took these warnings seriously. Today, Rachel Carson's fable has almost become a reality. We hear of agricultural towns where the cancer rate among children is 5 times what it is elsewhere. We are told that the salmon can no longer make their way up the rivers to spawn because of all the dams and hydroelectric plants in their way. And the number of songbirds dwindles every year. Whether we imagine a fiery nuclear holocaust or a silent but deadly pollution, we do not see the phoenix or any life rising from the ashes. On the other hand, we do experience in many ways the fact that life is tough and resilient, as well as delicate and fragile. In our personal lives, the pain of loss or suffering is transformed in time to deeper understandings and compassion. The pain of divorce or widowhood has been the beginning of self-assessment and growth for many people. In the wider world, the vicious bombing during World War II of the precious cathedrals of Dresden and Coventry led ultimately not only to beautiful new buildings, but to deep ties between people across the boundaries of nationalism. And the rugged insects seem impervious to all our chemicals, simply developing new super species requiring ever stronger doses of insecticides. An insect, if not a phoenix, apparently will rise from any ashes. But somehow these facts no longer give us much comfort or hope. We don't quite believe in these images anymore. We can no longer accept that somehow, no matter what terrible things we do, life will go on and evil will somehow be transformed into good. We tend to call that wishful thinking, and we find more truth in the grim fable presented by Rachel Carson. Ironically, that fable carries with it an enormous belief in our own power. I think we rather like believing that we hold in our hands the power to destroy life itself. We may be terrified, but we are also thrilled. And that is exactly where we need to look for the phoenix. Right here, in and among ourselves. Consider the final words of Rachel Carson's fable. No enemy action had silenced the birth of new life in this stricken world. The people had done it themselves. The people had done it themselves. We have the arrogance to believe firmly in our power to destroy. We have the bombs, the chemicals, and the hatred to prove it. Why then do we not find it possible to believe just as firmly in our power to create? Do we not have the poetry, the knowledge, and the love to prove that? I would suggest to you that we are still victims of an old familiar doctrine which proclaims the inherent evil of human nature. We believe in our potential for arrogance and destruction, and we're right. But why do we not also believe in our just as real potential for humility and nurturance? It matters where we place our faith. As long as we have faith in our evil ways, we will surely fulfill our own gloomy prophecies. What would happen if we placed as much faith in our potential for good? What if we committed ourselves to develop that potential to its fullest? What if we poured all our energy and creativity and money into our most humanitarian projects? What if we withdrew our energy and creativity and money from the bombs and the pollutions we know are destructive? In the final chapter of her book, Rachel Carson wrote, "We stand now where two roads diverge, but unlike the roads in Robert Frost's familiar poem, they are not equally fair. The road we have long been traveling is deceptively easy, a smooth superhighway on which we progress with great speed, but at its end lies disaster. The other fork of the road, the one less traveled by, offers our only chance to reach a destination that assures the preservation of our earth. The choice, after all, is ours to make. We need to acknowledge our potential for evil and our attachment to this lopsided view of ourselves. But if we are going to rise like the phoenix from the ashes of our arrogance, we need to accept and develop our positive potential. We need to leave behind the barriers that separate us. We need to come together as human beings and develop our ability to act responsibly and cooperatively. Most of all, we need to have faith in our potential for good. There are no saviors for us because there was no fall. We affirm our place within the natural world. Our human search for knowledge has led to good as well as evil. Let us celebrate and implement the good. I'd like to close with these words by Theodore Parker, one of our great 19th century preachers. He said, "Be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space. Its shrine, the good heart. Its creed, all truth. Its ritual, works of love. Its profession of faith, divine living."